So, Bill, shake, rattle, and roll engineering is what I'm calling today's show.
Oh, good.
Do you like it? I mean, is it rock and roll reference?
I was going to knock your mommy's tsunami, but okay, we'll go with that.
But the tsunami, of course, that messed with the Fukushima nuclear reactor was a result of an earthquake.
Right.
So the question is, what have we learned? Will we learn anything? What's going to happen?
Well, and I think another general issue is you can build structures to with enough safeguard for a certain level of catastrophic events, but you can't completely protect any, with reasonable cost, protect any reactor or any building anywhere from certain levels of earthquakes and all
right. It's always a balance.
Yeah.
Right. And to discuss that balance and how we design structures to deal with this and other contingencies, perturbations, right? We call them perturbations, but, you know, the people that got hit by the tsunami would probably use different language. We've got Professor Bruce Allingwood from the Civil Engineering Department here at Georgia Tech to talk about that very thing.
Yeah.
Right. So that should be interesting. And if you've got a question or comment about engineers designing structures and what exactly that means, by all means, give us a call. Next up on Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Don't you wish that getting your child to eat right, move more, and spend less time in front of a screen could be as easy as pushing a button? Well, you have more power than you know. The National Institutes of Health's We Can program can provide you with tips and tools to help your child stay at a healthy weight. Call 866-359-3226 for a free We Can Parents Handbook and visit wecan.nhlbi.nih.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology.
I live on a street near the university. Are you getting this, kid? Don't know if I did.
Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who uses so much hair gel he can be considered an adiabatic process, Bill Hunt.
I've never had such a rude thing said to me before.
You know, if our audience, we aim to educate as well as entertain.
True.
So I was looking through the scientific glossary, right? And every once in a while, when I get
adiabatic,
desperate for a joke, I was in the A's. I looked up adiabatic, which, of course, is a $10 word for a 3-cent concept.
Yeah.
The concept, of course, something that's perfectly thermally insulated. There's no heat exchange between it
between
and the
me
environment.
And the external world, through my head.
But and then I thought of you and hair gel, which is an insulator, isn't it?
I think so.
I'm guessing
it's
it is.
Not a good conductor. I found that out the hard way.
What did you put your hair in the light socket?
Yeah, it didn't work.
All right, so the title of today's program is Shake, Rattle, and Roll Engineering, where we're going to be talking about the implications for designing structures to deal with shake, rattling, and rolling. And our guest today is Professor Bruce Allingwood. And can you tell us a little bit about our guest?
Yes. He is a College of Engineering Distinguished Professor. He did his undergraduate and graduate work at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. From 75 to 86, he was at the National Bureau of Standards. Then he joined the faculty at Johns Hopkins and came to Georgia Tech in 2001. And was the chair of the department for a couple of years, and then he decided he was allergic to being an administrator. Probably
as most good engineers do.
Yeah. And he's a National Academy of Engineering member, so we're privileged to have him on. And also he's been to Japan several times as a structural engineer. So his area is structural engineering. And, you know, the application of methods of probability and statistics to structural engineering, which seems kind of odd because if you got a house, you don't know what's the probability that my house is going to fall in. But in reality, you do have things like this unlikely event of the tsunami and the earthquakes. And, you know, there is some probability associated with a variety of things with structural engineering. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here with you.
Right. And that's actually not such a funny thing, right, associating probability with engineering, because you have to.
Right.
I'm thinking back to 2009 when Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy is Threatening Our Future, pointed out that that's our problem. We come in and we'll give them the 90% confidence intervals on a particular piece of data. We'll talk about the 100-year flood because we need that to design things. Whereas politicians go, well, how do you know? Can you ever be 100% sure? Well, you can never be 100% sure. And that's why we get our butts kicked, according to Chris's co-author on that book, when we go in and talk to congressional folks.
Well, people, you know, that they deal with these probabilities in their daily life. You know, there's some probability that, you know, I was going to die in a car wreck today on the way to work. You know, if I'm...
And the way you drive, that's not trivial.
No, knock on wood, I've never had an accident ever, either my fault or anybody else's. But, I mean, you know, but you still get out of your house. Right. So there's some probability that something wrong is going to go. But you deal with that, you live with that probability. We have to do the same thing with these structures as well.
So along those lines, let's at least start with something that's relevant to what we're talking about today, designing structures to deal with things like earthquakes and tsunamis and probability. So let's begin the program as we often do with
Science in the News.
And today's Science in the News comes from the New York Times on May 16th of this week by Peter Baer, entitled Fukushima Disaster Deepens U.S. Turmoil Over Nuclear Waste Storage. Right, and this is something that we've been well aware of. You've got spent fuel rods, whether they're in dry or wet storage, you know, meaning still sitting in the liquid part of the reactor, sitting around for years. Scientists have understood why this is not a good thing. That's why we've worked on projects like Yucca Mountain, which, by the way, bad choice of name, Yucca Mountain. I like yucca plants, but it just doesn't sound all that great.
Doesn't sound tasty.
But they point out that Japan's nuclear disaster and the abandoned Yucca Mountain repository are combining to create a more complex puzzle for U.S. policymakers wrestling with the future of nuclear power in the United States. On Friday, a Blue Ribbon Commission, not red, not green, Blue Ribbon, Bill. They actually abbreviated it BRC in the story.
You're kidding.
A Blue Ribbon Commission of experts appointed by the Obama administration presented subcommittee reports calling for the expedited creation of one or more consolidated interim sites for storing spent fuel from the commercial U.S. reactors. More than 70,000 tons of spent fuel and varying levels of remaining reactivity are currently in wet or dry storage at various reactor sites. They're also looking to form a permanent site, right? And this is stuff, scenarios that have been discussed many, many years before. For example, in 2009, Dan Tedder was on the program in a program we called Weapons-Grade Allegations, talking about reprocessing of fuel, one of the ways that you can maybe reduce the total amount of stuff you have to put in a site like Yucca Mountain. They actually point out that the site chosen should be welcomed among the neighbors. Yeah, good luck with that one. I mean, I think we need to eliminate a lot of scientific illiteracy before we can actually get people to understand that with the right management, reprocessing, things like that, you can actually do this reasonably well. But, I mean, you know, that was maybe one of the contingencies we had to deal with in Fukushima, right? A lot of different things. You can design things to deal with reasonable, I guess, perturbations, you know, sort of assaults on these things. But it's always the other things that we think about. And one of them really was less of a science issue and more of a policy issue, as we were reminded in 2010 by what Rob Butera, a Jefferson fellow who spent, what, a year trying to explain science to the State Department, and Richard Bark from our own School of Public Policy explaining how policy gets made from science. Sometimes it's a very slow process because we give them a good example, but they don't always get it. As he pointed out, representatives in Congress are always running for re-election. In any case, maybe that's something relevant to what we're going to talk about today. All right, so Michael's, our engineer, is giving me one of these notes. I can never read this. So we had a caller already. Wanted to know, probabilities will be calculated for events, what data, et cetera. Okay, Mike, what does that mean exactly? Or Trent, what does that mean?
The caller was asking, how do you calculate probabilities for those various events when you're talking about flood and stuff? What data do you use? I was pretty sure you guys were going to cover that already, but...
Should we start with that? Bruce, is that a reasonable place to start?
Sure,
yeah.
Go ahead.
We can.
There are several ways of calculating, you know, the probability that that are used for design purposes for structural engineering. Of course, the ideal way of calculating them is to rely on actual data. But there are some problems associated with that. One problem is that for the very, very low probabilities of failure that we're concerned about in assuring public safety, that the samples of data may not be large enough for us to be able to calculate those probabilities with any consequence. That's with any accuracy. That's one of the problems with earthquake probabilities in the United States, at least, where we commonly deal with earthquakes with a probability of 1 in 5,000 years occurring, for example, and we only have approximately 300 to 400 years of actual data in the United States. Well, 300 to 400 years of occupancy, and then the data, of course, are much less than that. And so, we do the best we can. We rely on information provided by the U.S. Geological Survey, historical data. We rely on information provided by NOAA when it comes to wind and snow data and precipitation. And in situations where we don't have that information, we supplement it by developing meteorological or geophysical models that will allow us to extrapolate out beyond the realm of observed data, out to the probabilities that are believed to be of interest in actual public safety and decision making.
So an example on the probability: if you talked about something probabilistically, there's something called the central limit theorem. I believe that if you've got a large enough value, everything becomes a Gaussian distribution. But you've got to have a lot of samples to do that. But so what you're saying is there. We don't have enough earthquakes over a short period of time to get the kind of probability you associate with the bell curve and all these other kind of things. Is that?
That's basically correct. The central limit theorem, of course, is a useful tool in trying to estimate what the distribution might be. But there are a number of assumptions that underlie it, and many of the assumptions that we deal with in modeling extreme geophysical or meteorological phenomena may not necessarily be necessarily be valid.
Right.
So that you can apply that. But the basic idea is to utilize the information that you have supplemented. By the best geophysical information or the best mm-hmm. meteorological models that you possibly have to come up with estimates of what the probabilities of the event being exceeded might be. And the U.S. Geological Survey is very good at this. They spend a great deal of time devising seismological models to enable us to extrapolate mm-hmm. out to great earthquakes. And we do the similar things when we're modeling hurricanes. Mm-hmm. Of course, the modeling process changes as more information becomes available. If I look at, for example, earthquake hazard maps as we construct them now and compare those with earthquake hazard maps dating back from the late 1970s, there are some significant differences in them, but that's just the nature of science. Mm-hmm. We learn more and we get a better estimate as to what the probabilities might be. I will say that over a period of time that as we collect more information, as the models become more sophisticated, that that there is less and less change from year to year than there would have been at a stage when the modeling was relatively immature.
Right. Okay. So just to kind of get some basics going here, so what is a tsunami? What generates a tsunami?
Okay. A tsunami, simply put, is a water wave or a series of water waves. Characteristically, it has a very, very long period and a very, very low amplitude in the open ocean, and that has some significance, as we'll see as we discuss it a little bit further. The key thing is that a tsunami is generated by some sort of an impulsive mechanism that's associated with the displacement of a very, very large volume of water. If you think of, you know, if you have a young child that you give a bath to at night, and the child beats on the water with his hands like this, and it causes standing waves to propagate in the bathtub on a very, very, very small scale. That's what a tsunami is. It has nothing to do with the tides. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was a tidal wave.
Yeah, some people call it a tidal wave, but it has nothing to do with the tides.
So when you say impulsive, that means it happens with large force over a short period
of time.
Very,
very short period of time.
So, you know, acoustically, it'd be like clapping your hands.
That's correct.
That's an impulse. So when you've got this sort of the tectoral plates, sort of sliding in a jump from one to the other, that's kind of the an example of the impulse response.
Well, the people associate tsunamis with earthquakes, of course, and that probably is the most common.
Okay.
The most common source of a tsunami, at least from the interest of the public, but any sort of an impulsive event that gives rise to a large displacement of a volume of water could generate one. There was an enormous tsunami generated by the explosion of the volcano Krakatoa back in 1883, for example. There wasn't any significant urban development in the area, of course, and so it had very little impact. But submerged landslides can cause tsunamis. Explosions of nuclear devices will cause a tsunami. One of the largest tsunamis was caused by a land subsidence in up in the Aleutians, and there wasn't anything around, and it was very, very localized, but the standing wave created by the tsunami was like 150 feet or something like that, but its effect was very localized. So anything that can cause an impulsive displacement of a very large volume of water could give rise to a tsunami, or may give rise.
Okay. Now, so how fast does it propagate? So let's say you get an earthquake or one of these impulsive events in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. How long does it take for it to get to Japan, for example?
Well, the earthquake in question, of course, was generated about 80 miles east of Sendai. But as far as how fast the waves propagate in the open ocean, they propagate very, very rapidly indeed. There's a very simple formula that's used for estimating the rate of propagation, and it basically amounts to the square root of the acceleration due to gravity multiplied by the depth of the water over which the propagation is occurring. So in mid Pacific, where the average depth to the seabed may be something on the order of 6,000 meters or 7,000 meters or something on that order, you could very easily have velocities of propagation that were on the order of 250 meters per second or 500 miles an hour. It's a very, very rapid propagation. And so, to answer your question, how long would it take to propagate from the trench just east of Japan to, for example, California? Well, it may be something on the order of 10 hours, perhaps. Or something on that order. It's important to note that the amplitude, while it's propagating in the open ocean, is very, very, very small.
So, by amplitude, you mean the disturbance on the surface of the ocean? It doesn't look like
so
much.
So, it's a bad surfing wave in the open ocean.
It's a very, very bad surfing wave if you're out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
In the open ocean, it has a very, very long wavelength, but the typical height, the typical amplitude of the wave may be something on the order of 1 to 2 feet max.
So the wavelength would be from crest to crest.
Right.
It would be a really long distance, for example?
Oh, 100 miles, maybe.
Wow.
50 to 100 miles.
So you'd get a little bump, and then you go another one 100 miles distance.
Now normal ocean waves typically have a wavelength of something on the order of 30 to 50 meters max.
Right.
So to give it some comparison, you're talking about a completely different order of magnitude. But because it has this very, very long wavelength, it can propagate for very, very long distances with very, very little loss of energy. And that's important.
Okay. I keep interrupting you.
He's good at that.
Yeah. you get this impulsive event, and then, you know, it doesn't look like much on the surface. It's 100 miles between, and it's propagating seemingly a long time, 10 hours, right? Mm-hmm. But on the surface, the displacement is how much? Are we talking?
Perhaps maybe a foot, 2 feet, something like
so
that.
So that's nothing compared to the swell.
Oh, if you were on if you were on an ocean liner, you wouldn't even feel it.
But as you point out, the speed is proportional to it's multiplied by the depth, right? Mm-hmm, so that's right. As it gets shallower and shallower, does all that water then bunch up as it slows down?
Yes, it bunches up, and keep in mind that you this long distance of propagation. Of this very, very long wavelength wave, the characteristics of the wave propagation are that you lose very little energy, and so that energy has to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so when it reaches a coastal area, the wavelength will compress. Mm-hmm. The velocity obviously decreases, but the amplitude of the wave will increase greatly because right. Now keep in mind that the energy has to be conserved, basically, mm-hmm. and except that which is dissipated. And so you convert this tremendous energy into a very, very rapidly rising wave carries tremendous force with it can wash a long distance inland. Sometimes it just looks like a rapidly rising tide. Sometimes it looks like a tidal bore. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with the Japanese artist Hiroshige, I'm very fond of Hiroshige, by the mm-hmm. way. But he draws these ink washes of these enormous waves with the breaking waves, and tsunamis very, very rarely actually have a breaking wave. Mm-hmm. Usually, it's more like a tidal bore. But the height of the wave as it approaches shore may be 50 feet, 150 feet in height, mm-hmm. And the velocity may be something on the order of 50 feet per second, 60 feet per second, something like that. In the Japan earthquake that occurred recently, the wave heights as high as 120 feet were observed. By the time those waves on the other side of the Pacific over in California and Oregon, the waves were maybe something on the order of 6 to 8 feet in height. By the time they reached there, they were enough to do minor damage mm-hmm. to pleasure boats and harbor, docks and harbors, but they didn't have any significant structural impact at all on the eastern side of the Pacific.
Wow. And 6 to 8 works better as a surfing wave. That's all I'm saying. Boogie board, fins, things like that.
You and your scuba diving.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk about these tsunamis and exactly what this means with regard to designing structures to deal with them, both in Fukushima and around the world. And if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, you've got a question or comment about the civil engineering of structures to deal with these sorts of things, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back on Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
This is Friction. Friction Wednesdays, 10 p.m. on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Wednesdays at 11 p.m., WREK Atlanta plays an hour of the finest psychedelic music, spanning everything from kraut to space rock to freak folk to psychedelic pop. It's called Psych Out, and it just might change your life. Tune in Wednesday nights for some of the most colorful rock music produced over the past 50 years. You can check out our playlist at WREK.org/psychout. And tune in Wednesdays from 11 to midnight here on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Professor Bruce Ellingwood of the Civil Engineering Department. And it's actually Civil and Environmental Engineering, right?
Got to get
that right. People get mad if you don't do the titles right. Yeah. I know my boss does.
Well, I won't.
Okay, that's good. Here at Georgia Tech, about tsunamis, earthquakes, and how civil engineers design structures for that. And again, if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, and you've got a question about exactly how engineers, civil engineers, deal with the design of structures to deal with these things, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468.
You had mentioned off-air that in 1978, you had your first trip to Japan, and this was after an earthquake and a tsunami, and this is with the National Bureau of Standards.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that trip and what kind of things you came into at that time.
Well, at the time, I was in the structural engineering program at the National Bureau of Standards, now referred to as NIST. We were part of participants in a U.S.-Japan panel on wind and seismic effects. And following the Miyagi-Kenoki earthquake of 1978, which incidentally occurred, its epicenter was actually not too far from where the current earthquake occurred. It was about 80 miles or so east of the city of Sendai. I was invited to be part of a team that went over and looked at earthquake damage in the Sendai area. And on the way up to Sendai, we stopped in Fukushima, what is now called Fukushima 1 in the news. And we stopped there for a day to look at what had happened up at Fukushima. It was of interest because it was the first time that a modern nuclear plant had ever been subjected to strong ground motion. And so naturally, there was a great deal of curiosity as to how modern seismic-resistant design practices would work in a modern plant. At the time, it was the largest nuclear power plant complex in the world. It still is one of the largest, but it's no longer the largest. And at the time, four units were actually operating. It was commissioned in 1971, and of course it was under construction for a period of time. And at the time, there were four units that were operating, there were two that were under construction. And so we were not allowed to go inside of the operating units, but we did make a thorough inspection of the units that were under construction. The peak ground acceleration, which is a way that we measure the strength of an earthquake for structural design purposes, was well within the design limits. The plants had been designed in accordance with a seismic design practice.
So let me ask a question there. So you'll say the process is sort of, you go, well, under this kind of seismic or earthquake activity, we expect vibrations to be of a certain amplitude and frequency, and then with your analysis you say, yeah, it's not going to come apart.
That's correct.
At that kind of disturbance, and that's sort of the essence.
That's the essence.
Okay.
That we are within what the nuclear industry refers to as the design basis, well within the design basis.
Okay.
There was no sign of any damage to any of the buildings or the equipment. There was some damage to non-critical ceramic insulators in one of the electrical switchyards that weren't not too far away from the operating units. Now, that's important because it has to do with the loss of off-site power, which was a major contributor to the most recent damage. We were there, as I say, for about a day, all we learned at that time was that seismic design practice of vintage late 1960s, when the plants were designed, was acceptable to mitigate damage from an earthquake of this size. There was very little in the way of tsunami at that time. And the design basis tsunami for Fukushima 1, it was about 19 feet, and there are some barrier walls that are erected. Fukushima 1 is right on the coast. You may have seen pictures of it in the newspaper. I mean, there is you could throw a baseball into the Pacific Ocean practically from the whatever tsunami occurred at that time didn't even come close to overtopping the barriers.
And you showed me a picture of that from that report. Those barriers barrier. So there was sort of a barrier wall out closer to the ocean that was hopefully going to break up the tsunami. That was 19 feet tall, but obviously if you get a 130-foot tsunami coming in, that barrier wall is not going to do too much.
Well, our best estimate of the tsunami at in the recent March earthquake was at Fukushima was approximately 48 feet. So clearly, a 19-foot barrier is going to do very little to prevent a 48-foot wave from overtopping. And in fact, the tsunami was the major cause of the damage that occurred at Fukushima.
But you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the modern seismic resistant design principles. Uh-huh. What exactly are those, and what would an example be of how we design things now, even in the 60s, relevant to, say, you know, hundreds or thousands of years ago? Because you see all these old European buildings that are very brittle ceramic bricks and tiles. They just fall apart under these sorts of things. So what's an example of how we design now?
Well, one of the reasons that the older buildings actually perform quite well in many instances is that they were engineered by trial and error, and buildings that were engineered at the margin typically didn't make it into the 18th century, let alone into the 21st.
Survived.
Okay. Now, there are some notable examples in medieval Europe where the technology or the desires of the master builders far outstripped the capabilities in construction, and there were some rather spectacular collapses of cathedrals in France in the 12th and the 13th centuries before engineers came to grips with the purpose of a flying buttress and the need to carry that thrust from the arch down to the ground. So to return to the 21st century and your question, in a nuclear power plant design, and for that matter for most critical structures, we start with an estimate as to what the ground motion at the site of the plant would be, and that ground motion typically is provided by a knowledgeable geoseismological consultant. It may come from information provided by the U.S. Geological Survey, but it is intended to tell the engineer something about what the ground motion signatures might look like. And
so by ground motion signature, you're implying you've got both what's the amplitude, what's the spectral range like? Is it going to vibrate at 30 hertz or 20 hertz or 100 hertz?
Well, the key thing is at what frequency or frequencies is it going to cause the structure to vibrate? Because those are the considerations that determine the extent of damage that may occur. And a structural dynamic analysis, of course, is designed to shed light onto that particular aspect of the problem. And so for a modern nuclear power plant structure, generally a dynamic analysis is going to be performed with the idea of identifying the dominant frequencies of the response and being then allowing the earthquake engineer to design the members and the connections of the system so as to be able to withstand those seismic demands. That's very different from the way we used to do it in the early to mid-20th century, where just a static force was applied laterally to the building in the hopes that somehow or other you would simulate the inertial forces from the earthquake.
So basically you adopt sort of a frequency-dependent design. You look at these low frequencies that might occur in an earthquake and make sure that those vibrational modes allow the energy to be absorbed, dissipated, and hopefully not give you sort of a resonance frequency like we've seen in certain suspension bridges over the years with, you know, standing waves of wind underneath them, that sort of thing.
Well, the response of the structural system, of course, is going to represent the aggregation of responses at a number of different frequencies. But certainly what you say is correct. If you want to minimize problems associated with dynamic response, one way of doing it is to tune the structure effectively away from the frequencies that may give rise to significant damage. This is actually a very, very common technique in designing tall buildings for wind, perhaps more so than it is in earthquake engineering, because the typical earthquake demand spectrum is significant over a very broad range of frequencies, whereas the spectrum for turbulence in the wind has a relatively sharp spectrum, and so it's possible to actually tune the structure in such a way that response to wind may not be excessive, and various active and passive control systems that are sometimes implemented in tall building design are designed exactly to do that.
So an example to try to help out if people are having trouble thinking about what this resonance is, if you had a wine glass and tapped it with a fork, that's the resonant frequency of the wine glass, and if, you know, someone sang at that particular pitch, there was a Memorex commercial years ago,
right,
on this. But basically, if you had vibration at that resonant frequency of the wine glass, you would shatter the wine glass.
You would shatter the wine glass.
And so this is kind of so these buildings have resonant frequencies, and if you have a sustained excitation at that resonant frequency, you could start to have it come apart.
I'll give you another example, which maybe some of your readers may have, or listeners may have come across in before, and that years and years ago when troops used to march, when they would come to a bridge, the commander would tell the troops to break stride because bridges of certain spans would respond dynamically to the forcing function from people marching. And there were a number of bridges that were shaken down by troops that marched at the wrong frequency over the bridge. And so it was very common for the commander of the troop to order the troop to break stride as they crossed the bridge. And then once they crossed the bridge, then they could resume their cadence again. And that was exactly the same problem.
And it's a common thing. You think about just taking, whether it's the paddle ball thing or a rubber band. Usually rubber bands are elastic. They have one primary frequency.
Right.
You put a weight on it and move your hand holding the weight at any random frequency, may be irrelevant. You move it right at that frequency where it moves at that frequency. It absorbs that energy and basically will do so until you snap the rubber band.
Right.
Right? And that's what happens to bridges, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, things like that. But it's interesting. So you talked about active and passive methods for this.
Control.
When I think of active things, I mean, you could actually, you know, take mechanical motions and make them to counteract exactly the motions that are being applied. I know in large buildings, they often have large counterweights just floating around somewhere on a giant cable, things like that. Are those the sorts of things that are done for earthquakes?
No.
Okay.
Generally speaking, not, because in order for those, a control system to work properly, you have to be able to, the active control system at least, has to be controlled. And one of the things that you frequently lose in an earthquake is your power source. If you're relying on power to drive the active control system, which may consist of a series of tendons that are adjusted, and the tension may be adjusted to counteract the effect of the dynamic movement, if you lose your power source, you're in trouble. As far as passive control systems are, the example that you cited with the pendulum, for example, which doesn't require an external power source, is a tuned mass damper. Would be an example of a passive control system, but those are much less effective in dealing with earthquake-related response than they are with wind response, because the spectrum of excitation is much richer in the frequency range with earthquakes than it is with wind. With wind, the building typically responds primarily at its fundamental frequency of vibration, the example you cited with the rubber band, and so it's easy to design a passive control system to counteract that. In the case of earthquake, usually many frequencies will contribute energy to the response, and it's difficult to design a passive system that can, with efficiency, can match all of those frequencies.
Right, and when you say the active system with all these tendons, so basically you've got some sort of restraint, a cable that you can tighten or loosen sort of dynamically to take into account this response.
The key part of the active control system, what differentiates it from a passive control system, is that the active control system, generally speaking, requires an external power source of some sort.
Right.
And if you're trying to mitigate an event in which you're likely to lose your power, then the active control system, is not a particularly good choice.
Right, which was actually one of the problems with regard to the Fukushima incident, right? It was power loss?
The source of the difficulty at Fukushima, as best we can determine it, and I'll remind your listeners that it's just fairly recently that Tokyo Electric Power Company has actually been able to get its people in there where they can have a careful look at what actually happened. But what appears to have happened was, of course, that the earthquake damaged the off-site power sources. And so the safety-related systems that were required to operate the emergency cord cooling and to bring the plant to a safe shutdown condition would be the diesel generators, which are on site. But the diesel generators were submerged and rendered ineffective by the tsunami. And so there was no way to all that leaves is the DC source, the battery source, and that really is intended for running the instrumentation, not for running the cooling systems. And so the fact that the tsunami damage caused the loss of the diesel generators, which meant that the plant effectively had no way of running the pumps that would be necessary to cool the core in the shutdown condition.
All right, so we need to take a quick break, but when we come back, hopefully we can examine that and maybe do a bit of a postmortem on that. One of our callers, while we were in the air before, is interested in what kinds of precautions we can take to protect against tsunamis like this in the future. So we'll be back after this break, but if you are listening live Wednesday, noon to 1, by all means give us a call in the studio if you've got a question or comment for Professor Ellingwood about this very interesting topic at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.
Listen to The Longboard Show, playing 50 years of surf and instrumental rock every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on WREK.
Every Thursday from 6 to 7, WREK Atlanta features Tech Talk, the radio program about everything and nothing. We feature the weather, traffic, news, pop culture, politics, science and technology, and all issues on or off campus relating to Georgia Tech. That's Tech Talk, every Thursday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., here and only here on WREK Atlanta, where quality meets diversity.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Professor Bruce Ellingwood about design of structures and dealing with things like tsunamis and earthquakes.
So one of the questions, what was the actual damage to the nuclear reactors this time?
It's, as I mentioned before, it's we're still learning because it's only been fairly recently that the people have actually been able to get in and get inside the containment and have a look. I can give you a judgment as to what happened. There was evidence of course, I mentioned that the tsunami disabled the emergency generators, the diesel generators, and there is evidence of a partial nuclear meltdown in units 1, 2, and 3. That would result from inadequate water in the core to cool the rods. There were some signs of hydrogen explosions which occurred in units 1 and 3. This has to do with the chemical reaction that occurs between the steam generated by the rods, which even in a cool down condition are still extremely hot. And at a certain point, the chemical reaction that takes place between the rod coating and the steam may separate hydrogen out from the steam and may give rise to an explosion. There's evidence that that happened in three of the containments. There's a possibility that there was some damage, some partial uncovering of the spent fuel in the spent fuel pool, which is adjacent to the containment. And so, to summarize my answer to your question, it seems pretty apparent that it's very likely that there was a partial meltdown in three of the reactors, and that there was some local damage, that there was an evidence of some cracking in the suppression pool of one of the reactors, which was the source of the radioactive iodine and cesium that was detected in the water supply in Fukushima. And so I think we'll know more, you know, within the next few weeks about exactly what the level of damage happened to be. But I think it's important to realize that this damage probably was not a direct effect of the earthquake, but rather it was caused by the fact that the cooling systems couldn't operate properly in mitigating the effect of the accident.
Okay, so this was a circa 1970 reactor design, or more recently deployed nuclear reactors better capable of handling this? Or so if this had been something built in 2000, would it have been avoided these problems?
I hesitate to give a definitive answer to that, because I think in this case that the problem had more to do with the backup safety related equipment in the plant and protecting the emergency core cooling system from a very severe extreme external event, rather than from any inherent deficiency in the design of the reactor itself. A nuclear power plant is an enormously complex facility, and a lot of things have to work properly in order for safety to be maintained. And under almost all circumstances that I'm aware of, in fact, they do work properly. Situations like Chernobyl occur because of human error in large measure, situations like Three Mile Island. This one here, I don't know that there was a direct deficiency in the design of the reactor itself, but rather perhaps some question regarding the level of redundancy in the design of the backup systems. There's a phenomenon known in risk and reliability analysis where you try to design redundancy and fail safeness into the system, and that means effectively that if one system that you're counting on fails, then there's another one that's ready to step up to the plate and take its place. But if all of those systems are affected by the same event and may fail as a result of the same event, we call that a common cause failure, and probabilistic risk analysis enables us to identify those types of failures. And sometimes they may only occur when you're dealing with an event that's a very, very long distance outside the design basis, as this one was.
So, and this is a very important point. I mean, what we're saying, and it certainly looks this way, that the structure was not significantly damaged by the effect of the tsunami and the earthquake, meaning the whole, you know, the containment building didn't fall in or fall over or collapse on itself. Yeah, I'm not sure there's much you can do about that, and that's certainly something you want to avoid. But could it have been avoided simply by taking the backup diesel generators and moving them up inside the building a few stories to avoid the water flooding?
It could have. If the backup diesel generators had not failed, there's every reason to believe that there would have been some local damage there, but they would have been able to control the situation. And my reason for saying that is that there is another nuclear plant, which is about 10 clicks south of Fukushima 1. It's called Fukushima 2. I've never visited that one, by the way. But it has four boiling water reactors, which are somewhat newer than the ones that were at Fukushima 1. It was brought online in the early 1980s, and there was some damage at Fukushima 2, but all four of the reactors were brought successfully to a cold shutdown within 4 days of the earthquake. And the increasing level of protection for the diesel generator systems at Fukushima 2 may have something to do with that.
And I mean, is the failure simply due to the fact that people designed for one of these probabilistic events and they said, look, here's the height the water's going to get to, and it got to significantly higher than that?
In very simple terms, yes, that's what happened. Yeah. When you design a nuclear plant, the vendor, the AE, the architect engineer, has to submit to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission documentation to justify the so-called design basis. And the design basis would include some stipulation regarding the ground motion that the plant has to withstand. It typically, in the central part of the United States, is going to have things to say about its resistance to tornadoes and tornado-borne mm-hmm. missiles. If it's on one of our rivers, it'll have something to say about what flood level you design it for, and so forth and so on. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you know, with its technical staff, reviews these submissions, and they make a judgment, sometimes with the aid of consultants, as to whether or not that design basis is adequate to meet 10 CFR 50, Code of Federal Regulations, which governs the design of nuclear plants. They don't generally require one to design for an event that's so far beyond the realm of experience that it can't possibly occur. They mm-hmm. require that the plant be designed so that the risk is effectively as low as reasonably practical, which means that you have to design it to be very, very conservative, and certainly much more conservative than the typical building inventory that we have in the United States. But there is no idea that you design for zero risk, because in the face of uncertainty, you cannot have zero risk.
So as an extreme case here, you wouldn't design the reactor to withstand a comet striking the ground 50 miles from the location of the reactor. That's very unlikely.
Generally speaking, yeah. That's correct. But if your reactor is situated within a certain distance of a runway at a certain major airport, then the reactor is going to have to be designed right. for the possible impact of a Boeing 747 right. or 737.
Rather. Right.
And it's always the side effects, I think, that are a problem. I recall I was actually teaching a class when the airplanes crashed into the buildings in New York. And a student brought it right up there, and we were looking at it, and I was explaining to them how that was designed to take that kind of an impact. But the thing you didn't think about was the hundreds of thousands of gallons of jet fuel that were burning for hours and hours and hours. And that was the thing. So the Fukushima mm-hmm. reactor was designed to deal with certain earthquake and tsunami contingencies, mm-hmm. but not a tsunami wave above a certain height. Seems like, and actually the whole thing about, you know, softening reinforcing girders in the Twin mm-hmm. Towers seems like a simple thing by hindsight, and I don't want to pick on my engineering colleagues. It happens a lot.
Well, and you know, back to Professor Ellingwood's point about the Middle Ages and those structures, there was a willingness to learn from your mistakes. I mean, I think there's certainly ability to learn from this and move forward. It's just with the media and everything now, we think, somebody's got to be blamed for what happened as opposed to get after fixing it.
Well, we're dealing with in many cases, unfamiliar technology, and many people fear unfamiliar technology. So the idea that you can arrive at appropriate levels of safety through a sort of a trial and error process, as we've done over the centuries, is an idea that no longer has much currency, and it's one of the reasons, I think, for the rise of the discipline of probabilistic risk assessment, particularly in dealing with critical facilities subjected to very, very low probability and high consequence events.
Right. And it's those rare events that are hardest mm-hmm. ones to design for. So we had a couple of callers that had some interesting questions. We had a building inspector was wondering about the connection between hurricane prevention and tsunami sort of risk assessment. Is there any connection between the two, or are they very different sorts of events?
Well, I don't want to be glib. They both involve water. But the level of the hurricane storm surge, as I understand it, is not on the same level as the type of tsunami inundation that we have seen in the Tohoku earthquake, the recent earthquake. The other thing that I think is an important consideration is that With hurricanes, typically there is some period of warning before the hurricane makes landfall. Now, you can, in theory at least, you can try to evacuate people. Sometimes they won't move, and that's a separate problem. The engineer can't deal with that. But at least there's some period of advance warning where people can take appropriate action. You know, all the Home Depots on the coast, the Gulf Coast in Florida, mm-hmm. Do a booming business every autumn mm-hmm. For that precise right. reason. Right. With an earthquake, you have very, very little warning. In the case of the Japan earthquake, the amount of time required for the effects of the tsunami to be felt in some of the coastal areas of Iwate and Fukushima Prefecture was on the order of 20 minutes. And so there is very little way that you can evacuate large populations to preserve life in a situation like that. About all you can do is have a tsunami warning system, which the Japanese do in that area, by the mm-hmm. way. And in fact, they have something that we would call a reverse 911 system in those prefectures where once a tsunami warning has been issued, that all of the homes are called mm-hmm. to warn people to get to higher ground. But there's very little way that you can evacuate large populations of people with a tsunami, as there is with a typical hurricane, and so I think the risk mitigation issue, I think for hurricanes as opposed to earthquakes and earthquake related effects is very, very different.
Right, it takes Bill 20 minutes to get off the couch to answer the phone. So yeah. Trent, was there another aspect to that question?
He was also wondering what the guest thinks of the current building codes, and it was more. Do the building codes for hurricanes help with the building codes for tsunamis, or do you need specific ones? And he was just wondering what you think of the current state of kind of building codes in the U.S. for those kind of things.
We don't have significant tsunami risk in the United States, and so our building codes have not historically dealt with tsunamis. I am and have been involved for the past almost 40 years with American National Standard or ASCE Standard 7, which deals with building code requirements for design loads for buildings and other structures. We do have some requirements in ASCE 7 for the design of structures for flooding, both in the so-called V zones and the coastal A zones, and those zones are identified by the Flood Insurance Administration, primarily as a basis for insurance underwriting, but they do give the so-called 100-year maps so that people can determine what the flood level might be. And so we do have some requirements and some provisions for dealing with flooding in those areas. But the tsunami has not been a problem that we've had to deal with in the U.S., and so we really haven't addressed that problem. Nor do I think that it's a significant or a pressing issue for us to deal with in our current generation of building codes.
But in general, would you consider building codes reasonable? I mean, do you feel safe going into modern high rises, even when they're on Miami Beach?
He lives underground, actually,
in a bunker.
Yeah,
absolutely. And having been instrumental in bringing probability-based methods to the development of structural codes and standards and building codes, I feel perfectly safe with our current generation of building codes because I understand their technical basis, and I understand also that nothing that I do in life can be done risk-free, that risk can be managed in the public interest, and building codes and standards and their developments do that. And I think historically they have done it very well, and I don't worry about those things. We are left with events like the World Trade Center, which I classify more as a black swan, and I would never suggest that building codes be changed so as to make sure that if fully loaded 767 aircraft with 300,000 gallons of aviation fuel crash into the building, that it won't come down. I don't think you can design for things like that.
And so by black swan, we're talking about a rare event. You're not making any comment on the movie,
no.
Which I haven't seen, so I wouldn't have gotten that.
Okay. We're talking about very rare events.
Yeah, getting me to see the black swan, that would be a very rare event.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's actually a very good note to end the program on. that, you know, you have to take a probabilistic approach to those sorts of things. And as disconcerting as that might be for the average person, the one thing we get asked all the time, you know, as engineers and scientists about designing stuff is we can design most things very effectively. We can design them safely, but we can't design them effectively and safely and cheaply, right? And that's where the business part comes in. The reason you can't design skyscrapers to take a hit from the every possible aircraft is we'd never build a skyscraper. They would cost trillions of dollars a piece, or we'd never build anything above 10 stories or things like that. So I want to thank you for starting with that point and pointing out that probabilistic concepts are a very big part of this. Mm-hmm. You'll never design to make things completely safe.
Perfection.
Yeah, so if you're agoraphobic, stay in the house. It's never going to happen for you. But what you can do is you can design for a set of reasonable, conservative assumptions.
Right.
On which you know, assume you might get various perturbations in the form of tornadoes, earthquakes, things like that. And that's, I guess, what you're calling the design basis, right? So that's the design basis that engineers work on, this sort of hypothetical set of assumptions. And that, of course, changes from country to country, state to state, city to city, depending on what your big threats are,
right?
And, of course, the design basis near the Fukushima reactor might need to be modified to include a surge that's a little higher? Is that a reasonable?
It certainly would be warranted, yes, to reconsider the whole tsunami issue. In that part of Japan, tsunami barriers are actually quite common, but this particular earthquake created tsunami conditions along the northeast coast that overtopped the barrier, almost practically all the barriers. So certainly that needs to be revisited.
Okay. And that we also basically learned that it's sort of a frequency-based approach to dealing with earthquakes, right? Trying to make sure that this – and we use the word spectrum a lot. Mm-hmm. That's this whole distribution of frequencies. It's a little wider than dealing with wind, makes it a little harder design for earthquakes. Also the fact that, you know, compared to hurricanes and wind, really no warning, you know, and less of a surge. So earthquakes are and a rare event, so it's also tough to get those models done in terms of probability. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, and I appreciate this, is that changes decade to decade, year to year. As we learn more, we get more sophisticated models, and that's just the way, you know, engineering design is going to be. But despite all that, that may be a bit disconcerting to some of our listeners. Our guest at least feels good about building codes and going into it, as do I. So, travel, enjoy. That's what I'm going to end up.
Yeah.
Do we leave anything out that's important?
No, I think we well, one thing we didn't get to is Professor Ellingwood's on a National Academy of Engineering panel on wind energy, offshore wind, the structural integrity of offshore wind turbines. So I think that's be the subject for future future program.
Absolutely. So. All right. So with that, Bruce, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you very much for hosting me. I've been very pleased to be here with you.
All right. And if you've got a question or comment about this program or a suggestion for a future program on Inside the Black Box, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. Our chief engineer is Trent Altman, of course, sitting in very ably today is Mike Riley, right?
Yeah, Mike Riley.
I keep wanting to say O'Reilly. Why is that?
Because it's Irish.
Okay. That's Mike the Irish guy. That's how I remember him. But thank you very much, Mike. Our theme music is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt, and we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.